said yes is last several weeks I've been reading a book for part of my devotions in the morning. And I don't know if anybody's ever read this book. It's called The Disciplined Life. And what it is, it's a book that's given to first-year students at Bob Jones. I became associated with it in 2007 when Lindsay was going to school there. I just picked it up one day. It seemed pretty interesting to me, so I started reading it. And it's written by a old-line pastor. His name is Richard Foster. It was written back in the 60s. It was revised, and basically this is a revised edition. But again, this pastor, even back in the 60s, saw the deterioration of our society at that time, especially when he was trying to call back the church to a disciplined living. And I want to just share some of the things that I've gleaned from it. I'm not directing these things that can be done in regards to becoming disciplined to anybody here. I'm really directing to myself mainly and what they've meant to me. And I just wanted to share with you some of the things I've gleaned from it. You know, we live in a society that's unraveling. You know, everybody would have to agree that the people right now that are in leadership of our country are the hippies of the 60s and the 70s when I went to school. You know, they're the ones that basically thought they knew everything. They took no thought about it. They thought they were really smart people, because I was a socialist. I went to a very liberal college, you know, and basically I heard some of them. I was there when Kent State took place and when, you know, the disrespect for the soldiers coming back from Vietnam. You know, we have people that were, you know, burning their draft cards. You know, I wasn't one of them. You know, we had the draft lottery. My number came up real high, so I wasn't drafted. So in that respect, I was able to stay. And then also they had student deferments at that time, and my grades were good enough. And I was playing a sport, so I stayed in school. But if I had been called, I would have gone into the military, and I would have gone to Vietnam. My dad was, you know, served during Korea. My uncle was in Nam during the Tet Offensive. But I go into that because, you know, it was really rebellious at that time. You know, you had the hippie movement, you know, the free love, you know, the God was dead. You know, you had, you know, some sort of religious movement called the Jesus Freaks. You know, they were basically hippies that were basically coming out and using the Lord's name. And, you know, then it came into, you know, the Christian contemporary movement, where you had a lot of the songwriters from there were just, you know, people that were taking their music and basically putting scripture to it. But they never really changed. But this pastor, he came out and he wrote this book, and this book, you know, has a lot of biblical references to, you know, hard living, that Christians should live hard. You know, I don't know, and probably a lot of you remember Jim Baker and, you know, Jimmy Swaggart. Those people joined, you know, Peter Popoff, you know, the name it and claim it. You know, you have these TV shows of these personalities that would come on, and they would be supposedly Christians, and they would look really, really good. You know, they'd tell you, if you sent me $100, I would send you a bottle of water and you sprinkle on you and you get rich. You know, all these things that were going on because, you know, they turned away from the biblical standards of truth, and they basically, you know, had an alternative motive. And basically it was to get rich. It was the love of money. You know, they wanted the good lifestyle. So basically they promoted these things. Many of these people, well, many of them did end up in jail. You know, and many of them had, you know, moral lapses, you know, that caused them to lose whatever ministry they had or any credibility. But anyways, this Richard Foster, he comes out with this book, and basically in the book, it talks about, in the first part one, it talks about the discipline, the key to power, and it talks about national power, where as a nation, you know, if we don't live disciplined, then we're able to be overtaken by a totalitarian or dictatorship. You know, he was talking about communism. You know, the fact that communism, it's easy to move in. The communists want this. They want a soft society so that they can move in. And basically, you know, again, remember the McCarthyism of the 50s and 60s, where, you know, the anti-communist movement and all this other things. But basically, I remember Khrushchev, who was a premier of Russia, when he stood there, and he said, "We will bury you." And one of the things he said, if we could get to the educational system, they wouldn't have to fire one bullet. because this country would be defeated. And look what's happened to our educational system. And then it comes into personal power. And then it comes in when power, you know, when personal power tells. And it has to do, again, with the disciplined living. Then it comes into discipline, the mark of maturity. It talks about appetites, emotion, mood, speech, and priorities. And then adjustment to authority. And then the perils of discipline. Because there's a peril to discipline. Because, you know, you have cults that are probably more disciplined than most people that live in this country. You know, you look at the Mormons, how disciplined they are in regards to their living. You know, they don't drink or smoke. They don't do a lot of things. They're very hard workers, but really they've rejected the message of the gospel and the truth that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that he is the only, you know, way to heaven, and he can't be a God. He is God. So anyways, but that's one of the perils of discipline. Then you have Christian discipline, the danger of extremes, the unchristian asceticism. What about Paul and his discipline? And then the undisciplined discipline. And then it goes to discipline and holiness. And it talks about how discipline is not holiness. But then you come into part two, and it talks about how to become a disciplined person. And again, these are not exhaustive ideas, but I just wanted to go over with, you know, how to become a disciplined person. And I'm working on this on a daily basis, you know, where the Lord reveals things to me where, you know, my character might be a little loose, or some things that I'm doing is a little loose. Now, I'm a lot better than I was when I got saved 28 years ago. I mean, not 20, 34 years, when I was 28 or 34 years ago. But I came from a very undisciplined background, you know. And, you know, I did, but as I got saved, I realized that, you know, discipline creates an environment for holiness. Because without a disciplined character, you know, you can't really, you know, be separated for the service of the Lord. Okay, so, you know, some of the ideas. First of all, there was a quote that T.S. Ludwig had made, and he was a contemporary of this Richard Foster, and he was a pastor, and he said, God will not look you over for medals, but for scars. Okay, that is another way of saying he wants no pampered saints. In today's turbulent world, God needs disciplined men, soldiers tried and true, battle ready. The plight of modern man may be summed up in his striving for the road of self-indulgence. Look at our society today. You know, I was looking, just to give you one example. You know, I have a retirement at work, and I look at it, and that retirement is funded completely with tech stocks. You know, Google and Amazon, all these things that really have nothing to do with, you know, farming or anything like that. You know, we have become a pampered society. Everything is technological. The easy way is the best way. And everybody take, not everybody, but people take it because we default to our sin nature when the Word of God isn't preached. And it destroys a society. You know, anyways, but he's the plight of modern, okay, then the way of least resistance is his goal. Sacrifice, discipline, restraint. These words present ideas that are hard to come by in our generation. Then he comes in here and he says that, first of all, there's no shortcuts. On Luke 9:62, it says about the fact that, and Jesus said unto him, no man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. How many of you here would agree with me that the Christian life is hard? It's not an easy life to live. You know, we've been deceived if we believe that it is an easy life to live. You know, you have these gigantic churches that have 5,000 people that come to them. And you see some of the things that are being preached out of them. You know, the easy life. You know, if you do this, you know, you're going to have riches and everything. That's not the Christian life. You know, there's many people that have nothing in this world. And basically, you're going to see them in heaven with riches. Riches that God will give them. But in this world, our striving should never be after riches. And really, there are no shortcuts. It says here, undisciplined person forever is seeking ways to avoid the arduous grind of solid work and to arrive quickly at his goals by shortcuts. If you need to reinforce motivation, then ponder soberly and honestly the end result of drifting through life as an undisciplined person. You know, I ponder that on a daily basis. You know, when my alarm goes off, for example, and many of you here would understand this, we don't want to do certain things. But then, you know, either the Lord reveals it to us or our common sense comes back and says, we've got to do it. We've got to do it because it's the right thing to do. You know, it talks about Christian character, where we do things because it's the right thing to do and it glorifies God. So as a result, we go and do the things we need to do and then take care of them. Second, a disciplined person seeks to avoid making unnecessary work for others. He is also concerned about the aftermath of not just a good showing. You know, how many times when I go to work, where I'll see, for example, in a snack room where I manage a part of the company, and you have boxes of pizza just sitting there. Nobody takes care of it. And I'll come in and pick it up. We don't have a cleaning service, you know, or something like that. I see people in this church, you know, for example, when we have like something like a dinner or something, everybody will pitch in and put the tables away or do things like that. You know, it's just that you just don't want to create work for other people. And that's just Christian character to do that, loving your neighbor as yourself. Third thing, whip the hard ones. Do the first things you would rather do last. There's a good example in this book of a man by the name of Wallace White. He was a plumber, but he was training to be a missionary at a seminary. Well, the headmaster at this seminary found out that this Wallace White was a plumber. And there was a gigantic plumbing task that had to be at this seminar because the plumbing hadn't been updated. So Wallace White, what he did was he went ahead and he volunteered for it. He found out that when he started, you know, examining what it was that he had to do, it was about a 6-month project. So he thought to himself, well, it's going to affect my studies, and I'm not going to be able to put forth my best in regards to my training for being a missionary. But he felt to himself that, you know, in his past, he had quit a lot of things. So in this particular time, he was going to tackle this hard problem. What he did the whole plumbing job, and basically what he testifies to the fact that it helped him as a missionary, because he remembered that one instance in life where this task was so hard that he continued on and did it. And when he felt like quitting, you know, on the field, then he chose not to quit. You know, he continued on because he remembered it. And sometimes in our life, and the author of this book talks about, yeah, there's times when we volunteer for something that, you know, we have to gracefully say, you know, this is over our heads, or we quit. But we don't really want to establish a pattern of quitting. You know, I say that, you know, to young people. You know, you don't want to establish a pattern of quitting. You know, for a long time before I got saved, I had established that pattern. And it was an awfully hard pattern for me to break. And the Lord really worked hard with me. I think one of the reasons the job I have, and I've had for 34 years, why I continue, it was a really hard job because, you know, you didn't get a lot of accolades for it when I first started. And it was a lot of hours. And usually it was 7 days a week because newspapers, you know, they published most of the time 7 days a week, 365 years. So I was on call all the time. But what it did was it reinforced me. I didn't quit. And just like this Wallace White, you don't want to ever establish a pattern of not quitting. Because once you establish it, it becomes a habit. And habits are really hard to break. Even when you get saved, they're really hard to break. Even with God's help, they're hard to break because you establish that pattern. And then... it talks about cultivating punctuality. That's what I'm working on, is trying to show up on time. But there's also other issues in regards to punctuality. For example, he goes into like paying your bills on time. You know, there was an article I read the other day that banks today make $3 billion a year on overdraft charges. $3 billion a year. People write checks out and they don't cover them. And then they don't cover them, and it costs them $35 or $40 to bounce a check. And he said, oh, well, I'll pay it, or I won't pay it, or I'll just close the account. $3 billion a year. When I read that article, I couldn't believe it. There's some countries in this world that their GDP isn't $3 billion a year. So just, you know, that's what he was talking about. Then he talks about girding up your mind. Talks about how this is no day for disorganized minds to be flapping around loosely in breezes of impulses. God demands trained minds. You have no right as a Christian to be mediocre. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's going to, you know, ascend to certain positions, because certain people God bless with talents, you know, managers or owners or companies, or, but you have no right in a position that you're in to be mediocre. You know, I have a very good friend of mine gave me something that Abraham Lincoln said. He says that he does the very best he can. He does it every day, and he'll do it till the end. And it's a very simple thought, how Lincoln was. You know, and I'm a pretty good student. I read a lot about Lincoln and how he was as a person. You know, he was a man of sorrows, but he never quit. You know, and by the time he was 50 years of age, he was assassinated. But as he led our country through the four most turbulent years, you know, he really did depend on God. If you ever read his second inaugural address, if you get a chance to read it, all the references to Scripture and all the references to forgiveness and all the thoughts that he had of Reconstruction whenever, you know, he wanted to forgive the South, although he died and, you know, the North was really harsh on the South when he died. But the point was that, you know, he never quit. And, you know, he was a man that really worked hard on doing the best he could. And, you know, he's just a man, and the Lord himself did the very best he could every day. Now, he was God, but he's our example. So, now another thing is number 6, exploiting the unexpected. We must remember that when something unexpected arises, and it always arises in a day, is that we got to see that fretting is folly. There's no sense in complaining about things or anything. The second thing is we've got to thank God for hidden providence. How many times has something gone amiss in your day? And what happens is there's something really good that comes out of it. I mean, there's many times in my day where something has gone bad, but there's some opportunity to witness to somebody, seeing another person's need whenever something comes about. Because, you know, like this morning, I was out, and there's this fellow that I see from time to time. He's walking to Kraft, and I'm out delivering these papers. And I give him a paper from time to time because I have some extra papers. But this morning I got an opportunity to give him a ride to work. And he appreciated it. But for me being able to give him a ride to work, I was able to invite him to church. Now, whether or not he'll come, but see, he didn't expect that. And see, it took a little bit of extra time out of my day and everything. But, you know, it was providence for me to be able to see him. Maybe tomorrow I'll see him and give him a track. I didn't have any tracks on me. And he was rushing around anyways. But maybe tomorrow I'll see him and give him a track. But he'll remember that. You know, there's a lot of times. And this is just and I know all you have personal examples. You know, I got a little bit involved with the mission in Winchester because I knew the director there. He was a former missionary. And I got a chance and it was just by, you know, an unexpected circumstance that he came in to see me. And I have a heart for missions because I have a brother who right now is an alcoholic. Well, he's a reformed alcoholic. He hasn't drank for 5 years, but you know, to have a heart for these people and the needs of these people. And, you know, I see my brother in these people. But it was just an unexpected circumstance that this fellow showed up. And it talks about Romans 8:28 about how, you know, and you guys know Romans 8:20, all things work for good for those who love God and are called according to His purpose. Then, this is a good one here. Love your critic, okay? Cultivate the attitude of sincere gratitude for all correction. That's a hard one, isn't it? When people correct you. You know, when a boss corrects you, or I'm not married, but when your wife corrects you, when your friends correct you, you know, when they point out something from you, or even your coworkers. You know, I've had people come to me thinking, I'm having a great day, I'm such a great boss. And all of a sudden a coworker will say, Mr. Green, you did this. Well, I did. And, you know, really it humbles you. But we have a problem a lot of times. We got to remember that supersensitivity, when corrected, shows immaturity. You know, how many times, and I go back to my children, but my children were children. When I would correct them, they would always have an excuse for it. You know, now they're 20, 30 years old, and one of them has two little girls. And I talk to that one every morning, and he talks to me about how, you know, his little girls are challenging to correct. And I just remember when he was a little boy, and now he's getting the same thing. But I'm just saying it is a lack of shows immaturity. And then in Proverbs it talks about how we're to be courteous to all, you know, everybody, even when they criticize us, because there might be some nugget of, you know, correction that will help us. And really it humbles us too. Another thing is self-restraint practiced in three areas as a Christian: in curiosity, prejudice, and dogmatism. You know, we shouldn't, you know, try to get into other people's business. You know, we should restrain ourselves. Even if we hear, you know, again, this is what this is, and I'm working on this too, is not getting in, you know, not trying to find out too much about people unless they want to tell you. You know, you might hear a rumor or something or gossip, but not to try to get into it too much. You know, as a manager, I hear a lot of things about what my people are doing. You know, but most of it's untrue anyways, and most of it is just, you know, people wanting to get back at other people. But I'm just saying, in another area, in prejudice. You know, as Christians, we've got to be very careful about being prejudiced, you know, about judging others. That doesn't mean that we're not to confront them with their behavior, you know, if we get an opportunity. But in regards to trying to, you know, prejudice why they do things, you know. And then about dogmatism, you know, about what we believe. Now, we can't alter certain things that God says. You know, we can't alter the fact that, first of all, we know, you know, whatever, you know, our doctrine is, you know, biblical doctrine. But there are some things that we can agree to disagree on, that we don't have to, you know, have a pitched battle with people, you know, regards to, you know, standing for certain things that we believe are truth. And it talks about how, in curiosity, it says a Christian restraint not only has opinions, but allows them. And that's a good point there, is that as a Christian, you know, we should expect other people, if they want to hear us, that we should hear them too. In curiosity, prejudice, and dogma, therefore, let your moderation be known unto all men. And it talks about that in Proverbs 18:13. Then this is another one here. Conquer gluttony. There be abstinence from poison. We should abstain from poison. You know, poison such as drugs or alcohol or smoking, things that will destroy our bodies and do things. We should abstain from them, but from and temperance with food. But it talks about how, but intemperance is sometimes more difficult than abstinence. Would you agree with me? It is harder to be temperate than it is to be abstinent. If you just say, I'll tell you right now, it's easy for me to sit down and say, well, I'm not going to eat food for 6 hours. But then when the 6 hours comes up, now, some people might look at me and say, Bill, you're not telling the truth. But, yeah, I can't go for 6 hours without food. I can go for a day without food. But the point is, I can go that time, but whenever I eat, then it becomes a struggle with me because I like goodies. So I want to overeat. But I'm working on that too. But we should be temperate with food, especially, again, in this culture, you know, this society we live in, food is in abundance. And not only is the food in abundance, it's addicting. The food companies have made it addicting. It has a large amount of sugar, and it has a large amount of salt, and they know what they're doing. And if you leave, and you know, one time I was addicted to McDonald's hamburgers, but you know, because the stuff, I know people laugh, but I loved them. But you know, I don't love them anymore. But it's not funny because what happens is, you know, that compromises our temperance. You know, our restraining ourselves from eating. And then it talks about how eating is not sin, but gluttony is. Life is shortened by self-indulgence. What will we say to our defrauded king when we stand before him if we come there earlier than we're supposed to because we didn't take care of ourselves? You know, and not only thing, but it compromises our ability to serve. You know, I know it does. When I overeat, it's hard for me even to work. You know, because you want to fall asleep in the afternoon. So, anyways. And then it goes back to, you know, 1 Corinthians 9:25-27. And this is a good one here, too. Learn to respect time lags. It talks about the process of maturation cannot be hurried. And only disastrous consequences will accrue when we try. And then it talks about that in Ecclesiastes 3:1. When there's a season, you know, there's seasons of time for things. You know, I don't know, again, about you guys, but as you see the world as it stands, it's a very impatient world. Everybody wants everything now. They expect it now. Everything. When you go into a restaurant, and it's amazing, as I work at the newspaper, they're complaining about certain things all the time anymore. You know, the customer service that comes in. You know, I have carriers that are contracted, and I have some really, really reliable carriers. They've been with me for, some of them have been delivering routes for 7-8 years. I have one carrier that's been there for 30 years. He comes faithfully every day, never missed a day, 6 days a week. And I have had a challenge with even people complaining about them. You know, from especially the one that's been there 30 years, has had the same customers. You know, customers that have her, but they complain about, you know, certain things. You know, where I'm just saying it has become that way in our society, and that we're very impatient about getting things. And then another one is welcome the yokes of life. What he talks about as welcoming the yokes of life is, for example, everybody here has simple ministries that they do, whether it be ushers or, doing the nursery or whatever, okay? Well, Moses, for 40 years, stayed in the desert until God called him into his ultimate ministry. 40 years. You know, Paul, before he was called to be a missionary, I believe it was 15 years. And then David, before he became king of Israel, after he was anointed, was 10 years, you know, running from Saul. But they accepted those yokes of life until they got into their ultimate ministry. And how many times have we seen, you know, people that are elevated too quick, or people that are young and have talent that take it upon themselves and move themselves up with disastrous consequences because they lack the maturity in order to get into certain positions. You know, I worked for several years for Gannett. And Gannett at the time, you know, was probably the most respected newspaper corporation in the country. And I saw with the corporate that they would take young people, you know, people that were just out of college because they looked good and they could talk well, you know, 21 or 22 years of age, and move them up into management positions. Well, that was fine until the recession hit of 2008, and I saw Gannett stock because, you know, I remember they funded it. We got matching as department heads in that. We got stock options with certain companies, and I saw the stock take a dive from $61 a share to about $8 a share, and it was all based on the fact that I saw the culture in the corporate world where they were elevating young people into positions that really should have never gotten into positions. And when the recession hit, you know, it was found out that many of these companies, their strength was based on the debt that they had. They were fine while the economy was good, but this is what they were taught, these young people in colleges, that debt was good. They continued to expand based on debt. And anyway, but they weren't welcoming the yokes of life in regards to being young and taking their time to advance through, and to become managers that way. I remember, again, when I started with the newspaper, I was in one position for 5 years until I was elevated. Then I was elevated, you know, I stayed in another position for 10 years, and then another position for 2 years, and then I was able to take a directorship at a paper. But, you know, I put 17 and a half years learning, and then not only that, but I went back to school at night to get my, you know, master's. So, you know, all that work, but it helped me, you know, to be able to master certain things. And now I work for a newspaper that we don't run on any debt, that everything we pay in cash. So when things happen, we don't, you know, when a recession happens, we're not servicing large amounts of debt. But that just shows you that, you know, the yoke of life, it can be in business or whatever, but you have to be able to take it on yourself and be able to be satisfied with where you are until God moves you on. And then lastly, we want to cultivate a pattern of prayer. I know that from being associated, well, that's not lastly, it's next to the lastly. But I know being here with the people that I know that I call brothers and sisters, I know that many of you have had successful and, you know, cultivate the pattern of prayer. You know, and I think that many of us, you know, go to the Lord, you know, not as much as we should, but we're learning and we are growing in the fact that we have to really depend on Him for all things. And then lastly, it talks about how we should develop a philosophy of discipleship. It talks about how to endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. It talks about how Paul was not always happy, nor Luther or Wesley. And more recently, you know, somebody like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who I've had the privilege of reading about, you know, how they went through things and they endured hardship. You know, in this society, again, you know, it's amazing how, you know, just looking at my position, when things are really, really hard, there's only and I have about 25 people that work under me. I can depend on maybe two or three out of the 25. that will stay around, that will work with me until the end. We had a problem several years ago, and Mark will know what this is. A PLC went out on our insertion equipment, you know, and what it does is it controls it. Well, we need that in order to insert the paper with inserts because this paper makes money from that. Well, we were hand-inserting our newspapers, and that's very time-consuming. There was only a few people that stayed with me the whole time. It was on Christmas Eve. It was about four, and there was nothing we could do about it until we got the, you know, the PLC back in. But I just remember that there was, I don't see it here in this church. I see, again, people really trying to get involved and help and stay around to the end. But we should continue to cultivate the philosophy of discipleship. And finally, the last thing, in conclusion, is that we have to remember that discipline is learning, but discipline won't save you. And only you can be the most disciplined person in the world and the strongest person without God's strength. At some point, that discipline will break because we're only human beings. And something will overwhelm us. And remember, it talks about also in Hebrews about the fact that God disciplines us and He chastises us. And then it goes back into James that we should count it all joy when we have these things happen to us. Because when these things happen to us, we have to remember that God loves us because He's working with us. You know, in my life, and like a lot of you here, you can testify about the fact that there's certain things that have gone in our lives. And they're really, really hard at times. But when we come out the other end, depending on God, whether it takes 4 years or 6 years or 8 years, and we're on the other end, and we see what God has done through those years, and it's been really, really hard. But, you know, you have to ask yourself this question: would you want it any other way? And I would sit down and say, as hard as these things have been, you know, that I've had to go through, I wouldn't want it any other way. Because I've learned that God, first of all, loves me. Secondly, I probably would have had to go through them anyways, and I'd rather go with them, with the Creator of the universe, than by myself. And that's what I would say. And, you know, when God calls us, when He saves us, I've realized, too, it's just the beginning, you know, of our learning process. You know, a lot of times in our culture today, as you look at the churches, there's no really discipleship or teaching. You know, they want to get you saved and that's it. But, you know, life is really hard. And anyways, but does anybody else have anything to add? I'm done. I hope you've learned something from what I shared with you, because I try to go over this list every morning, you know, to see how, you know, I can correct my behavior and how I become more disciplined, you know, just to become a good soldier, because I want to have a faithful witness when I stand before Him. And I know all of you want Him to say to you, you know, well done, good and faithful servant, no matter what it is. So that's all I have. Thank you. Oh.